Hi there, my name is Prakash Chandran, and this is a Pfizer podcast series. In this episode, we are asking Dr. Aroni questions submitted by you. Listen in for an interesting analogy about obesity and lung cancer. Let's start with reviewing medication profiles for medicines that might be causing weight gain or preventing weight loss. So, how do you work with primary care providers and other specialists to optimize background medication regimens?
As far as the medicines, when you think about it, there are medicines that people take that are absolutely mission critical. And under no circumstances do we want to change them. An example might be an antipsychotic agent in someone with real psychosis. There, often it's taken time to find something that works for that patient. But at the same time, the leading cause of discontinuation of antipsychotics is weight gain. So, of course, talk to the psychiatrist. There are some antipsychotics that are more weight neutral than the most effective ones. And sometimes we can recommend co-prescribing another antipsychotic, which seems to mitigate the weight gain effect. But again, now that we have more effective treatments, we are tending to just work around that and go right to the anti-obesity treatment. Right? In the past, when we only had phentermine, topiramate, things that were psychoactive, we tried metformin. If that didn't work, you know, what were we going to do? Now that we have GLP-1s, it gives us more latitude. But the key thing is to work with the physician to come up with a strategy that'll work. And if they say, look, there's no way we can change this medication, and we're consultants, we won't change anything.
What kind of education is needed to bring obesity medicine to the forefront?
One of the things that we're living with is the legacy of medicines that have hurt people or haven't been effective enough. Some of this is not true, but that's the way physicians think about this, that, oh, you're going to lose 5% of your body weight, that's useless, or, you know, something bad's going to happen. As we develop these new, more effective treatments, I think that physicians are going to get increasingly interested in treating the obesity. In the avant-garde are already doing this. Like, they see somebody and they'll say, thing we're treating is weight. Nothing's being done for the problem that's driving all of the other comorbidities. The question is, how do you bring it up with them? And it is awkward. So there's going to be a lot of education that has to happen in the next few years. But I believe that within 5 to 7 years, we're really going to see the treatment of obesity taking away that I've always.
So have you seen barriers to insurance coverage, particularly if a patient has achieved good results?
The GLP-1s that were covered, namely Saxenda, you know, which was the only GLP-1 covered for weight, if someone lost weight with it, we would see continued coverage. However, now with the approval of semaglutide, there has been so much demand. Insurance companies have apparently taken note of the fact that it's very popular. And what we're seeing are somewhat onerous prior authorization rules and ongoing prior authorizations that we've never seen before. So normally, getting a prior authorization for drug approval is a yearly process. Now they've taken it to every 3 months. You have to have a patient documentation of a visit during that period. You also have to have documentation of the weight loss. The patient has to have lost a total of 5% of their body weight. Now, they don't have to keep losing 5% every visit. I mean, that would be absurd. People would have to get down to 100 pounds. But you have to document their success, and specifically greater 5%, that 5% milestone, which is turning out to be critical to insurers and employers. Why? Because 5% weight loss reduces the risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 50%. They'll pay for that. You know, we're going to get a lot of pushback at some point on $1,400 a month for a chronic drug that I calculated that if 2% of the population, which is the penetration of medical obesity treatment in the population right now, it would be a $33 billion drug. think about if it got to 7%. I mean, you're talking about, you know, something that really is going to seriously impact healthcare funding. So I think that we're going to have to come up with cheaper solutions.
So is there any genotype or phenotype data that you use to make decisions about which agent to use?
There are large studies going on now to specifically look for this. And SNPs have been identified that efficacy or lack of efficacy. It's a really fascinating phenomenon, because if you could tell an insurance company, based on this genetic, there's 100% chance that this particular client of yours is going to respond to this medicine, I think that would really help get coverage for the medications. I think that the pharmacogenomics is going to be a lot more precise. Choosing phenotypes in a pilot study has been shown to be helpful. For example, if someone has cravings and thinks a lot about food, it may be that bupropion works well as a first-line drug. If someone has a low metabolic rate, it may be that phentermine would work well as a first-line drug. A phenotype we see all the time is people not feeling completely full, and they're able to override their sense of fullness. And GLP-1s seem to help with that quite a bit. We can use the phenotype to help us decide who will. This is a study that was done by Andre Acosta and colleagues at the Mayo Clinic. And there they used one medicine or another and showed that they were able to get better results than in another group of patients. This is not a randomized trial, by the way. In another group of patients where they just treated them in what they called a random basis, you know, normal state of the art. I think that we use phenotyping. You know, when someone comes in, we ask them, do you feel full? If they don't feel full, then we would use a GLP-1. We might use metformin because we know those work better on satiety. Whereas if someone has a lot of thinking about food, cravings, sweet cravings, we might start something like Contrave or bupropion along with naltrexone generically. That's kind of an intuitive version of phenotyping. So we do this right now and it works.
Do you have any thoughts about oral agents versus injectables?
I think oral agents would always be preferable. I think it'll open up the market to a huge number of people. And I don't see why it couldn't be as effective. GLP-1, when you think about it, is released in the gut and gets absorbed. I think it should be as effective to have an oral, especially a small molecule, right? The reason current oral GLP-1 has to go through gyrations is because it's a peptide. But a small molecule, no issue.
Can obesity be prevented?
Prevention is possible, but prevention has to occur before weight gain occurs. So once weight is gained, what that is telling us is that something has changed physiologically in the weight regulating system. In other words, damage has been done to the weight regulating pathways. Prevention can occur before weight is gained. So best analogy I can come up with is that treating obesity with a diet is kind of like treating lung cancer with smoking cessation. Right? It's good to stop somebody with lung cancer from smoking, but you would not expect it to have an impact on the outcome of the lung cancer, right? There are different processes. That's exactly what happens in obesity. Once the process is going, the two things, it's not exactly the same, because cutting calorie intake may improve hypothalamic signaling, but prevention has to start before weight is gained.
Speaking of diet, is there a difference between consuming animal versus plant-based fats?
Absolutely. And that's in the structure of the fats, the triacylglycerol components, so that in animal fat, you have more saturated fats. With plant fats, you have more unsaturated fats. One of the key differences are that saturated fats are solid at room temperature, whereas plant fats are oils, right? There are only a few. Coconut oil, for example, is solid. So, and that's because it's very saturated. So they have different melting points. So in general, plant fats are healthier than animal fats. But saturated fats seem to be less healthy. But coconut oil, there's a huge amount of debate about this because people have gone on this coconut oil kick. But coconut oil, if you talk to cardiologists who do this lipid stuff, they think it's as unhealthy as saturated fats from animals. The oil that has, in my opinion, been shown to be healthiest is olive oil. There are randomized trials where you give someone a gallon of olive oil and tell them to come back in a month with nothing in the gallon container and we'll give you another one and do that for 5 years. And what studies have shown is a reduction in cardiovascular events, primarily stroke. Strokes go down right away, fewer heart attacks, fewer cardiovascular events. Nuts were a close second to olive oil, so I would say that the addition of nuts and oils, primarily olive oil, to the diet can produce positive outcomes.
Okay, so it sounds like nut and olive oils have the most data for healthy eating. Dr. Aroney, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and wisdom with us over this episode and the entire podcast series. It's been a pleasure learning more about obesity medicine. Pfizer colleagues, we hope these podcasts have been a great way for you to review the internal trainings while you're on the go. If you have more questions for our KOLs or would like to receive more training via this podcast channel, please let your leadership know. Thank you so much for listening. This has been the Pfizer podcast series. My name is Prakash Chandran, and we'll talk next time.